This is a climbing harness, and I kind of fantasised about abseiling down into the theatre, into the pit tonight. I don't know whether that would have been allowed under present. No. So the talk is written with newcomers in mind. And we say, don't we, in Buddhism, that beginner's mind is really, really important. So imagine that. Imagine yourself kind of as newcomers. You haven't heard it all. You're kind of fresh and new, and I'll kind of relate to you on that kind of basis. So the central image of Buddhism is a lone figure, sitting cross-legged in meditation. And you might think, well, why do others come into all this? In the West, there's an emphasis on individual spiritual experience. And some people see Buddhism as the pursuit of, it's a private matter. It's something you do on your own. It's something you pursue on your own. Meditation is where you work on your mind, isn't it? In the privacy of your mind. So, do you need to be involved with others to practice Buddhism? Or can you do it on your own? Is that the way Buddhism is going in the West? The task of changing yourself can seem a very personal and individual task. Something you do on your own, can't it? We take responsibility for ourselves in our ethical life, in our meditation. The choices we make or do not make are our choices, and we must make them alone. So where do others come into all this? So tonight I'm going to be looking at the paradox, if it is a paradox, of alone or together. And that is the title of this particular talk, isn't it? Climbing the mountain, that's where the harness comes in. Climbing the mountain, alone or together. And I'd like to dedicate this talk to my teacher, Sangharakshita, who introduced me all those years ago to spiritual community, who founded this spiritual community, and all my brothers and sisters who are its lifeblood, who are my context. So we all live in some kind of social context. We might be quite sociable. We might not. We might have lots of friends. We might experience loneliness. Actually, you can experience loneliness if you have lots of friends. But we all live within some kind of social network. It might be quite cohesive. It might be quite fragmented. It might involve real meetings face to face with others. It might these days be more virtual. You've got hundreds of friends, you know, on your Facebook kind of account. I prefer those kind of one-to-one, sitting opposite people meetings myself. So these contexts together form what we call society, form what we call the world. In the modern West, and now in most of the world, and certainly in big cities, you cannot get away from people. Other people are all around. Our life depends on others in so many different ways, and they can make our life meaningful, and they can make our life miserable. Our conception of the world, the views we have, largely come from other people, don't they? We're influenced by other people, whether we like it or not, whether we know it or not. And in turn, we influence others. And that influence comes from all sorts of places, from our teachers at school, university, academics, politicians, religion, the media, newspapers, increasingly social media, celebrities, films, TVs, books, and our peers. Our peers have a big influence and exert pressure on us. For some, the word influence is pejorative, something rather negative, and it can be true. It can be negative, but influences can be positive too. I was thinking in this relation to art. So as a painter, you might say, you might talk about your early influences, and you mean that in a positive way. Or if you're a writer, you talk about your positive influences. But influences can be positive. Values influence us. Values of fairness and justice, social responsibility are positive influences. And those influences affect how we treat one another. So I was watching YouTube, as one does, the other day. I don't know what got me onto this particular site. I think it was something on a BBC site about charities. And there were these two little films. One was set in America, and it involved a child of about 9 begging for a little money in order to buy some food to feed her little sister. And she'd got a kind of cardboard sign asking for money. And she was an actor, so she wasn't really a homeless girl. She was an actor. And it was being filmed in secret. And you saw on the shot the hours, you know, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock. And she was there for 5 hours. And nobody showed any interest. They saw her, you could see that they saw her, and they didn't see her. They avoided her. So she didn't get sent. And at the end of it, they ask her how she's feeling. And although she's an actor, she's quite upset. She's quite upset because she hasn't engaged with others. Second little clip is set in Norway. And here we've got a small boy, about 9 again, sitting at a bus stop. The weather's obviously very, very cold, and he's just sitting in light clothes, and he's shivering. He's kind of visibly kind of shivering. And people come to the bus stop, and it's interesting to watch their discomfort at seeing this boy shivering. And they engage him in conversation. Again, he's an actor, it's being filmed in secret. And people start engaging with him. They take off their hat, they give it him. They take off their gloves. People take off their coats. One young guy took off his coat, gave it to the boy, and sat in his t-shirt in the cold. And it was really, really striking. They engaged with him. Everybody who came up to the bus stop engaged with him. And it was all ages. It wasn't just the old, or it wasn't just the young. Young, middle-aged, old, men, women, took something off and put it around the boy. They were really kind of engaged with him. I was really, really moved by that. They wanted to know why he was in that kind of position. And I was speculating about this with Abaya Kirti. I can say Abaya Kirti because and I know you all, and you probably know him. Why this might be, and he wondered in America whether, in America there's an attitude, there's a view that you can make it, anybody can make it. So if you don't make it, that's your fault. If you don't make it, that's your kind of responsibility. It's quite a strong Calvinistic influence in American society. In Norway, he was suggesting, Norway's got a very socially cohesive society. It's a small society, they care for one another. They are known for it. Now, you can't draw too much from these two little clips. And I'm sure, I'm positive, in fact, you know, in America there are some very, very kind of kind people. And in a way, we don't need to know which country the clips come from. It just shows you, I mean, different responses. One was indifference and the other was kind of engagement. So I know how I want to be responded to. I know how I want to respond. But I do know within myself the instinct not to get involved. Something is happening. I don't want to get drawn in there. I've got my life, you know, I've got my things to do. And I don't like it. I don't like it when I feel like that, when I respond like that. An example from my own experience, I was riding across the common, Midsummer Common, a while ago. And this young lad had collapsed and he was on the path, unconscious. And there was a woman there who was trying to help. And there was a crowd of people, little crowd, not a big crowd, little crowd of people watching. You know, didn't quite know what to do, I imagine. They're just kind of watching. So I stopped and I went over and she was on the phone. She got on the phone to the ambulance and she instructed me what to do. You know, so she said, take his shirt off. It's quite odd in a way. I don't even know the guy, you know, taking his shirt off to find out whether he's still breathing. And she's conveying these instructions, we are doing that. And this little group of people are kind of watching us to do it, doing it. And he was alive. The ambulance came. And we got on with our lives. We dispersed. So the accident had caused us this little human drama on the path, kind of breaking into our ordinary life, had caused this group of human beings, this little knot of human beings, to stop. And you could see with those people who were observing but didn't involve themselves, they wanted to, but they didn't quite know what to do. I don't know why I stopped, but I know it is the right thing to do. I stopped because whilst I may not know the person, they are a person like me. And I would want a stranger to stop and help my friend, my brother, my sister, and so on. Our lives, I really feel, are bound up with one another. We have, I believe, a responsibility towards one another. I believe to be truly human is to feel and act from this responsibility. And this response must be at the heart of any truly human community, and therefore of Sangha, of spiritual community too. I'm going to start with a quote from Bhante. I've called Bhante Sangharakshita in the talk because people might not know who that is, but I might slip back into Bhante again. He says, "The purposes of a community or spiritual community are utterly different from those of the group. They're twofold. Firstly, its members help one another to develop spiritually. Secondly, in whatever way they can, they help others outside the community to develop their individuality. In essence, a spiritual community is a free association of individuals. A spiritual community is not created by getting yourself a building, an exotic form of dress, and a long list of rules. You don't need a building. You don't need an authentic tradition. You don't even need a religion. What you need are individuals. That is the basic ingredient." I'm going to be returning to this free association of individuals later on in the talks. So its members help one another and then they reach out to others beyond the community. He says in the quote some interesting things, perhaps even some surprising things. It might surprise you that one of the things he says we don't need is a building. We have a building, the Buddhist Centre, because it helps. We could have had the talk under a tree on Jesus Green. And in fact, a couple of years ago, I did give a talk on Jesus Green. The weather is always a bit kind of chancy, isn't it? The weather's a bit inclement in the UK. But the centre is useful because people know where to find us, know where to come. But the centre is not the Sangha. The Sangha is something different. Like a house is not a home without people living there. God, that sounds very cheesy, doesn't it? So the most important thing is people, individual people. So I'm going to say a little bit about Sangha, what the word Sangha means, the different levels of Sangha. So the highest or deepest level of Sangha is called the Noble Sangha. And this is a Sangha of all men and women who have awakened to some degree to the truth that the Buddha himself realized. They reach the level of spiritual maturity and insight that cannot be lost. Then there is the Sangha of the committed, the ordained Sangha. Traditionally in the Theravada, this would be the monks. In the Mahayana, this would be the Sangha of all those who've taken the Bodhisattva ordination. And the Triratna Buddhist order is part of the ordained Sangha. Then there is the great Sangha, the Maha Sangha. And this includes everyone who is Buddhist, committed or not committed, all those whose lives are touched in some way by the teaching of the Buddha. And the Sangha, potentially the world, is the Sangha too. The Sangha needs to be an ever-widening circle. It needs to be reaching out to all people, inviting them in. So in some traditions of Buddhism, they see the monk as the real Buddhist. The lay Buddhists are second-class Buddhists. Their role is to serve the Sangha, materially support the monks. Bhante thinks it's crucial that a particular lifestyle is not identified with commitment. The danger is that just by appearing to follow that lifestyle outwardly is seen as enough. And you see this if you go to India. Doubtless there are monks in India and elsewhere who are genuinely living the Dharma life, but a lot of them are going through the motions, I think. In the Triratna Buddhist order, it's not your lifestyle that identifies you as committed or not. It is your commitment to the values of the Dharma that is the essential thing. Your lifestyle is important in as much as it needs to support your Dharma practice. It must allow you to express your commitment. It should be ethical and supportive of your values. If it isn't, it is going to be that much more difficult to practice. If it isn't, it is still possible to practice. You see this with some people. What Bhante has done in founding the order, I think, is to create a unified Sangha and made it possible to be a fully committed Buddhist and therefore a full member of the Sangha, whatever your lifestyle or gender. All that is needed is for your lifestyle to be an expression of the precepts. Bhante is a radical thinker, radical teacher. He goes back, he cuts right back to the root. I think that is the meaning of the word radical, isn't it? I might stand corrected on that, but I think that's the meaning of the word radical. He says that what you start with in the Buddhist life is the same as what Buddhism started with. And that is the individual human being, and that individual human being's experience. So let's go right back to the beginning. We can get a good idea of what it is to be a Buddhist and a member of the Sangha by looking at the origins of Buddhism. In the beginning was the Buddha. Not God, but in the beginning was the Buddha. Well, even that is not strictly true. In the beginning was a human being, a man called Siddhartha. And it was this human being who set out on a quest to find the end of suffering, to find out if there was an answer to the questions of old age, sickness and death. I'm going to say more about his story in the next talk, so I'd like us to jump ahead to the end of Siddhartha's quest. We know that after a long and often fruitless quest, he did indeed find what he was looking for, and more. At Bodh Gaya in northwest India 2,500 years ago, he gained enlightenment and became the Buddha, the awakened one. And we celebrated this recently, didn't we, at Buddha Day? In fact, last Sunday we celebrated it here at the centre. There is no Buddhism at this point. No disciples, no Sangha, no teachings. There's no one to be taught. There are no buildings, no monasteries, no monks, no precepts. Nothing. Everything is new. There is just one enlightened human being, the Buddha. A little later, after the enlightenment, the Buddha goes in search of his old companions. The Buddha had attained the deathless, complete and utter freedom from all greed, hatred and delusion. And this was a tremendous achievement. No one else had been able to do it. But that doesn't mean he would be able to communicate it to others. Would he be able to communicate that experience to others? Could it be communicated? It had never been done before. Would any human being other than the Buddha be able to realize it? He walked for several days and he found the five at Sarnath. And they saw him coming. And in the past they had admired him. If anyone could break through, they felt sure it was going to be Siddhartha, and they would be there, they would be on the spot. But he had given it up and taken solid food, and they'd felt frustrated, disappointed, and here he was again. They agreed not to show him the old respect, They wouldn't get up and greet him. But for old time's sake, if he wanted to, he could join them. He could sit with them. But as he approached and got nearer and nearer, they couldn't carry through their resolve. They couldn't remain sitting. They felt the force of his being. And they rose and they made him welcome. These men were seasoned veterans. They'd suffered hardship. They'd welcomed hardship. They were hardcore. And they'd met many teachers and gurus claiming all sorts of special attainments and wisdom. They'd heard it all in their time. There's a huge kind of wandering community in the time of the Buddha. There still is in India. They were not going to swallow something easily. They were not going to swallow what he said easily. He claimed he'd found the deathless and had attained supreme enlightenment. But how could he, when he'd given up the struggle and taken food? In the end, he challenged them. When had he ever spoken like this before? When? They'd lived with him for a long time. They'd seen him struggle. They'd seen his determination. But it was true. He'd never made a claim like this before. They trusted his integrity. They'd had long experience of it. And he was different. It was tangible. They could feel that. So they put aside their objections and they began to listen. And so it started, the first communication of the Dharma to living beings in this world era. They went into retreat. The ancient texts only give a very, very general outline. But we can imagine them meditating together, talking together, the Buddha guiding them deeper and deeper. They still needed to eat. So two would go out and beg food for the six of them. We can try and imagine the Buddha struggling to put into words his ineffable experience. They would listen. They would question. Perhaps they would get confused. I don't get it. Perhaps those who had begun to understand would be able to help those others who just couldn't get it. It was an intense time. These five weather-beaten men, intent on understanding, the freshly enlightened Buddha, still blissfully inspired with the freedom of enlightenment. So days passed, nights passed, the world turned. Would they understand? Would they see? And it's like one of these moments where the world seems to hold its breath. And then, after days of meditation with the five wanderers, days of communication, days of trying to put the wordless into words, something jumped across the chasm between them, and Kandanya woke up, and instantly the Buddha knew. He shouted out, even the text says this, he shouted out a cry of exultation. Kandanya knows. And at that instant, at that moment, the Sangha came into being. That's when the Sangha came into being. One by one, all of them came to see the truth and woke up. But it all began with Kandanya. It was as if a huge dam had been broken and the power of enlightenment, the force of enlightenment, poured forth into the parched and ignorant world. And I think it's very significant in the breakthrough of Kandanya to look at the context for that. Without this context, would that have been possible? Would it have been possible to communicate enlightenment? And the context is spiritual friendship. They knew each other deeply. They'd lived together for a long time. They'd kind of fallen out, hadn't they? When Siddhartha started to eat. Their friendships were tested, and it was in this context that the breakthrough happened. And this is something that isn't brought out very often, I think. The joy of the Buddha as his old friend Kandanya finally understood and became enlightened too. And at the birth of Sangha, there is joy, I think. Shortly after the five wanderers attain realization, the Buddha goes back on the road. It's still the very dawn of the Sangha. But there are now six enlightened beings in the world. This is the beginning of Sangha. So one morning, early, we meet Yasa, and he meets the Buddha. Yasa is a popular young man from a wealthy family, running out after the aftermath of a party, sick with himself and his pleasure-seeking life. He runs into the forest. I don't know whether you've ever had this experience of fed up with your hedonistic life. Maybe some of you need to think back a bit. Anyway, he runs into the forest, disgusted with his empty life, muttering to himself, "It is horrible. It is horrible." And he hears this voice. He hears this voice that says, "Yasa, this is not horrible. This is not horrible." He meets the newly enlightened Buddha and his life utterly changes. There's still no Buddhism yet. No order of monks. But there is the newly enlightened Buddha. And it is as if Yasa meets this force of nature and is completely carried away. Bhante, in a seminar once, tried to evoke this moment, what the Buddha was like at this time. And he says it must have been like a mighty river rushing over a precipice into a void. Not into nothingness, but into something that we can't understand. All of that water pouring over the precipice, nothing held back, absolutely nothing. Everything goes over. And where it goes, we can only wonder. Then that gives you a kind of flavour. So Yasa, then his mother and father, his young friends, altogether nearly 60 of them, all of them pour into the void too. They become enlightened. It's hard to believe in a way that these young people, attracted as they were by pleasure, through their trust in Yasa and their faith in the Buddha, change completely. Was it as sudden as this? Were they simply waiting for something substantial and meaningful to come into their lives? We don't know. It just seemed to break through. And when we read the account, the Buddha seemed irresistible. His message, the vision he opened up to them, was so much more than anything they'd experienced before. Nothing could compare with it. And it's very striking, I think, that the Buddha calls them together, these newly enlightened beings, and the first thing he does is to urge them to go out into the world and share what they'd seen, what they had become with others, for the happiness of the many, for the welfare of the many. So right from the beginning, the Buddha insisted that the message of the Dharma, its liberating message, must be shared by all. That's the purpose of the Sangha. So we have a Sangha forming before our eyes in this, with these stories. We have a teaching being articulated. For the first time now, there is a need. And right at the start, we have this strong exhortation to take it out, to communicate it to the world, to share it with the many folk, to those who will listen. And the Sangha was not the setting up of an institution with forms and rules. It wasn't about external forms, not essentially, not fundamentally. The Sangha is a way of relating that is born from a particular kind of communication with one another. A way of communication that begins to let go of the tightness and narrowness of self. A new way of experiencing is born, a new way of relating, a new way of being. I think you could claim that the Buddha's greatest achievement was not enlightenment, but was the creation of Sangha. Remarkable that the Buddha gained enlightenment. But the Sangha embodies the Dharma. The Sangha, the community, makes so many things possible. It makes treading the path possible. It makes communicating the spirit of the Dharma possible. Because Sangha is spiritual community. And that's the only real way of communicating the spirit. So this raises a question for me, and for all of us, I think, who are members of the Sangha. Are we doing what we can to share the Dharma? Could we do more? Could we help to create this kind of new world more? There's a danger, isn't there, in the Sangha. You join the Sangha, you make some very good friends, and you live within that. You live within that kind of what can be a very kind of pleasant world. And the Buddha, with those newly enlightened beings, trying to take them away, shock them out of that. We mustn't live in a bubble. Our Dharma life mustn't be a kind of refined selfishness. So the origins of Buddhism start with one man, and that man's quest for meaning, for truth, no matter what the cost. And it's vital to remember this, because it puts a human being at the centre, not God or some abstract principle, but the human being. The compassion developed by Dharma practice is not abstract. It expresses itself as kindness and concern towards real people. It's easy again in Buddhism, isn't it, to talk about feeling compassion for all beings. But it needs to express itself, the nitty-gritty of life, towards real human beings. The purpose of the Sangha is to keep the context alive so that the Dharma can flourish, so it can burn bright. And this is a context of spiritual, deepening spiritual friendship. We need to ensure that we pass on the fire to the next generation. We don't pass on venerable but cold ashes. We pass on the fire. And we can only do this if our practice is alive and full-blooded, and our friendships are real and deepening. So how does the Sangha ensure that it can pass on the fire? To answer this, we have to look at what is really essential about being a Buddhist. What is it that makes you a Buddhist? Going for refuge to the three jewels is, Bhante says, the decisive act that makes one a Buddhist. At the centre of Buddhism, you may know this very well, but at the centre of Buddhism are the three jewels, called that because jewels are precious, rare, beautiful. So at the heart of our spiritual life is something really, really beautiful. By Buddha, I mean both the historical Buddha and the awakened mind itself. The Dharma is both the way things really are and all the methods and practices that form the way. And the Sangha is the Sangha of realized beings, primarily, and then all other Buddhists. So what is going for refuge? Going for refuge means to place one's reliance on something that one believes is reliable. It is to seek security in something that can bear the full weight of our being. We're all going for refuge to something or to somebody. It might be material things. It might be to money. It might be to security. It might be to our loved ones. It might be to technology. But Buddhism says that these are not a safe refuge. They can't be a complete refuge. It's not that you don't have them in your life at all, some of these things, but you don't absolutely rely on them. You know whether you're relying on, for example, your computer too much, when it breaks. The disbelief when that happens. I know that so very well myself. I like connecting the word refuge with refugee. Refugees flee from danger. Something or someone threatens their well-being or even their life. They may be fleeing famine or civil war, pardon me, or persecution because of their race, their religion, their sexuality, or they hold views that oppose those in power. They may have been threatened with prison, torture, and death. I subscribe to Amnesty's International. I get their little magazine, and it's quite sobering reading. Particularly if you live in the modern West, if you live in the UK, you can have quite a kind of comfortable, I don't know, secure view about life. There's a lot of unpleasant things happening in the world. In terrible times where our very survival seems at stake, it is so easy, isn't it, to look after number one. And in the magazine, sometimes you hear about these stories where somebody's in that life-threatening situation and they reach out to others. They don't stay with number one. They reach out to others and try and save them too, try and look after them too. This seems to me the best of human acts. It seems more than human to do that when your life is being threatened. So the act of a refugee is an existential act. It's not an abstract idea that motivates them, but their need to survive and for their families to survive. And more than survive, they're looking for a better life. And they take refuge in something or somewhere that offers this security, this freedom from fear, that offers an opportunity for a more human life. When I think of myself going for refuge, I don't usually think of it in this sort of way. I think I did when I first made contact with the Dharma. I felt like I was wandering in the desert and I'd come across a kind of an oasis. God, I was so glad. I was so kind of happy. But then one gets used to it. It becomes kind of normalized, doesn't it? I don't know whether any of you make this connection with refugees and going for refuge. Maybe you don't like doing that. Maybe, like me, you don't do that. But I wonder if it might be better if we did make that connection. Better in the sense of awakening to something more existential and urgent. The Dharma isn't just one of a number of value systems more reasonable and more attractive than most. It's something much more profound than that. And if I saw more clearly its depth, the depth of the Dharma and my actual existential situation, I would surely understand more deeply what going for refuge is. With a refugee, there is a twofold movement. A movement away from danger, insecurity and fear. And a movement towards safety, security and freedom. The freedom to be oneself, to think one's own thoughts, to freely express oneself. The world, the Buddha said, is not a safe refuge. It's not a true refuge. And this is very disappointing, actually. But I think it is true. This lack of safety is of many kinds. On the one side, there is the actual fact that in many parts of the world, life is short and often brutal. It's interesting that we've got kind of some Mexicans with us tonight. And actually, you read the news in Mexico, I think more people have been killed in drug wars in Mexico than in the whole of the Iraqi and Afghanistan kind of wars. I say it's a war going on there. So life can be often short and brutal. On the other side, there is a danger of false security. And I think that goes hand in hand with material well-being and comfort. Life is precious, a precious opportunity. And we mustn't squander it by shopping. Of course, we will shop without... Essentially, we're not shoppers. And the danger is where the meaning and purpose of life gets bound up with consuming. One is not essentially a customer. I feel funny saying this working for Wintours. No, one isn't essentially a customer. One is a human being. Even if our full humanity needs to be kind of drawn out of us. Becoming a Buddhist is not just about eating healthier and using eco-va products. It needs to be much more radical than that. The true refuge, the Buddha said, is the Dharma. The Dharma is the way things really are. Advertisers don't tell us how life really is because they don't know. If we don't check their influence on our minds, we will never know. Bhante said that the real spiritual journey is a journey of emerging individual awareness, a journey from the group towards individuality. Only you can make that journey, but it's not a journey that you need to take alone. It is a journey that can be undertaken with others. It is a Dharma that makes a spiritual journey possible. To be able to accomplish the spiritual journey, you have to decide to do it yourself. How else are you going to find the strength and stamina and skill that you will need. But we find, if we're lucky, we find kindred spirits who have also chosen to do it too, and we can do it with them. So we go for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. I've spoken of the Sangha refuge being all those men and women who've gained realization and are now motivated by wisdom and compassion. The movement with the order at its heart is our context. So we don't go for refuge to the order, we go for refuge to the Arya Sangha. So you may be wondering, if there are any realized beings in the order, is the Triratna Buddhist order not a true refuge? Maybe this is a $1 million question, maybe this is a question of the time. And it's not an easy question to answer. It's only a true refuge in as much as some order members have decisively let go of ego clinging and are now motivated by the bodhicitta. The bodhicitta, the will to enlightenment for the sake of all beings. But who are these order members? Do they look different? Do they have different coloured cases? Are there any visible signs? I've got a story for you from the Pali text, and on the basis of this story, you may be able to tell. But I can assure you, you won't be able to tell by the end of the evening. So this is a story that illustrates what we need to know to be able to tell where another person is, spiritually speaking. Yeah? The Buddha is sitting with King Pasenadi of Kosala. They're both old men by this time, and they have known each other a long time. The king is a great admirer of the Buddha. The king supports all sorts of holy men and a few holy women too. And these wanderers are a very mixed bunch. Some of them claim all sorts of attainments and powers. They claim special knowledge and insight. Some of them look very impressive with their long, matted hair, their dreadlocks. Some flout all convention and are completely naked. Others are smeared in ash, some carry tridents. You can see this if you go to India, can't you? You can see the holy men like this in some parts of India. Some are genuinely trying to find the truth. Others are complete fakes, and some are just freeloaders. So the Buddha and the king are sitting there, imagine there's two old men, and a group of holy men passes by. The dreadlocks, the tridents, nakedness, smeared. Bring this to mind. A group of holy men passes by. Immediately the king is on his feet. Bowing towards them, he says, "I am King Pasenadi of Kosala." He says it twice. And then he sits down. He sits there and he turns to the Buddha and he says, "Blessed one, do you think these holy men are enlightened?" The Buddha looks at the king, who's asked so many questions over the years. He turns to the king and he says, "It's hard for someone like you, king, who is steeped in the world, surrounded by pleasures, and the holder of power and influence, to know such things." He says, "To know whether someone has spiritual maturity, you must be practicing yourself. You must be deeply practicing yourself. It is very easy to be impressed by outward appearance and charisma. Not only that, but you cannot know in a short time, but only after a long time. You need to live with someone closely, and you are able to observe them over time before you could know. Not only that, but you would need to see them in good times, when they are inspired and admired, and in bad times, when they are struggling and unpopular. In times when they are tested, and in times when they are applauded. Only then could you have some idea of their integrity, their ethical sense, their patience, their wisdom, their compassion." So that's what the Buddha says to the king. And the king smiles. He's been playing a trick on the Buddha. These aren't holy men at all. These are actors. It's very useful to dress your spies up as holy men. They can go anywhere. And people will say what they like in front of the holy man. They're his spies to find out what is happening in the country. So he's pleased that the Buddha hasn't fallen for that. The Buddha never falls for it, but he was trying again. So let me draw out a few threads from the Buddha's advice. He says, to know where someone is spiritually speaking, you need to be practicing yourself. Deep speaks to deep. You might be impressed with someone, and your gut feeling might be validated in time, or not. In fact, you might not be at all impressed by someone, and over a period of time, over a longer time, you become impressed by them. It works the other way as well. So the second thing is time. To see someone's integrity, you need time. You need to see them closely. This is the age of jet-setting gurus and lamas. You may be told in the publicity that this man or this woman is one with the ultimate. They are the embodiment of the absolute. I went to see, not for a talk, I was going to a talk of Subhutis, and there was a Darfree John. I don't know whether anybody's heard of Darfree John. He's one of these kind of gurus. And there's Darfree John poster. And at the bottom he said, he is the master that is one with the absolute. He's the embodiment of the absolute. Yeah, he didn't look as if he was, but I didn't spend very much time with him, so I'll, you know. So, you need time in order to know someone else's integrity. You need to see them, live closely with them. To see them in all the circumstances of their life, positive and negative. You need to see what they're like when they're tested and challenged. You need to see them when they are appreciated and inspired. In other words, you need to see how the worldly winds of praise and blame, pleasure and pain, gain and loss, fame and disrepute affect them. And you need to see this over a period of time. Of course, the same is true of us too. To get some idea of where we are takes time and changing circumstances to show. But what is the context for seeing all of this? You don't look at someone else's life as a cool observer through the window. The Buddha rules this out. You too need to be practicing. You see them closely, live with them closely. You see their ups and downs. How is this going to be possible? I think it can only be possible through friendship. You're not sitting in cool judgment of them. You're right in there with them. You're battling the worldly winds together. You find out about their integrity by really getting to know them, by developing your own integrity, by becoming friends with them, by deep concern and interest in them. You support each other in difficulties. You build up trust in them. You encourage each other, you challenge one another, you bring perspective back in for each other. So in good times you rejoice in each other, you're delighted in their progress, in bad times you stick with them. Only through spiritual friendship and the deepening of that friendship over your life will you have any chance of knowing someone. And that, in my experience, is a wonderful thing. Some of my friendships in the Dharma life go back 20, 30 years. They are the best thing in my life. They are the most precious thing in my life. But you don't really need to know someone is well advanced on the path in order to benefit from them. They don't need to be advanced on the path to help us. But they do need to be sincerely practicing. Bhante has encouraged our peer friendships, hasn't he? Our peer friends are very important to us in our practice. Often in the Buddhist tradition, spiritual friendship is seen as a vertical relationship. It's between disciple and guru. One of the characteristics, I think, of our movement is the emphasis put on peer friendship. Your peers are so important because they are at the same stage or thereabouts. In life, generally, we know the benefit of peer friendships. I think when you're young, you realise this. You can lose it as you get older, but they're important to all stages of your life. To be at the same stage of life with people, to be able to talk over the challenges, to talk over the discoveries, is really necessary. older, more experienced friends who've been through all this are definitely very important. But it's also great to know others who are right in there with you, at the same stage, going through the same things. A famous Buddhist sage said that in the beginning of our spiritual life, we don't need a bodhisattva. We don't need a great being to help us. We can be guided by an ordinary human being. In fact, at the beginning of our spiritual life, they will be our best guide. It's crucial you have a context for your Dharma life. You cannot get very far. You may not even be able to begin without context. If you're listening to a recording of this and live far away from other Buddhists, you can still be part of our context through things like free Buddhist audio, video sangha, clear vision, our books. And when you can, get on retreat. That applies to everyone, actually. Get on retreat. Getting on retreat is one of the best ways to see Buddhism as a whole way of living. It gives you a deeper taste of sangha. I called the talk Climbing the Mountain Together, no, Alone or Together, or something like that. And because climbing seems such a good metaphor for the spiritual journey. Well, it can be used in a not so positive way. I remember Christmas Humphreys, who was the first Buddhist I ever heard speak, talked about the Dharma life as climbing this mountain, hunking off great bleeding chunks of ego as you climbed. It didn't really appeal to me that very much. I preferred Bhante's image of extending out your kind of ego until you include more and more people within it, until it actually fades. Anyway, back to the mountain. You glimpse the mountain, perhaps just for an instant, and this may mark the beginning of your journey. And you may perhaps have to sustain yourself with that glimpse of something truer for a long time. But that glimpse sustains you, it guides you, it gives you your spiritual, your existential orientation. And now you have found companions on the same journey who can guide and encourage you. So to finish, I'm going to tell you a little story. Because I'm quite attached, probably, to this climbing metaphor. Any climbers here? Oh, that's a relief. Just one. My team at work, you know I work at Windhorse Evolution. My team at work went away for the weekend some time ago, kind of team building weekend. And we went to Wales, and we went to somewhere near the Clambarris Pass. I don't know whether you've driven through there, the Clambarris Pass, but it's a real magnet for climbers. It's so rocky, it's kind of quite, I don't know, quite archetypal in some ways. And we had two climbers with us. We had Arta City, and we had Jai Raja. And they were our guides. Some of us, not everybody in the team, but some of us decided that we would do some climbing. So we put ourselves in their hands. And I remember climbing into this. It wasn't easy to get into it. This is a harness, and you climb into it, and it supports you, and then you have ropes. These are ropes. And I felt like a small boy, actually, getting into my harness. I also felt like a cowboy, because it's on your hips, and you kind of, you walk in a particular way if you're a climber. So they harnessed us up, attached us to ropes, and they gave us some coaching. Not too much. They didn't tell us too much. They told us just enough for what we would need. And like a good spiritual teacher, doesn't tell you too much, just what you need. We learned how to help one another and look out for one another. Belaying, technical term, belaying and other technical things. And belaying is where you somebody's kind of climbing up and you're holding the ropes so that if they fall, you catch them. They don't fall down, you catch them. And then we set off, and suddenly it was my turn. I'd seen either Jairaj or Artisili climb up, it was my turn. And I'd watched others start out, but now it was me, and it was different. Watching some people do something and then you do it, it is different. Suddenly I was on my own, it was me and the rock face. And I had these really, really tight little shoes on that you wear when you're climbing. Horrible things, really, really tight. I had my guide above me, my guide was Jairaja. And we were roped up, he and I were roped up, and then my friend, I think it was Patrick, was roped further down. So I was on my own, I was struggling to find purchase on the rock. I couldn't quite believe that my legs would support me. You know, I was trying to do it with my hands, and your legs are much kind of stronger. So I was encouraged from above. Jairaja was shouting encouraging things, taking the mickey out of me as well, but shouting encouraging things. But I still had to find the handholds and the footholds myself. And there was a particular part of the climb where I swung around, and it was just a sheer drop. I swung around into the void, and it was just a drop. And although I was roped up, my heart didn't know I was roped up. My heart was kind of going like that. And the adrenaline was kind of pumping out. And I clung onto this bit of rock. Do you remember this? I clung onto this bit of rock. And for dear life. And then the bit of rock I was clinging onto started to wobble. And I closed down. You know, I could feel panic beginning to rise. And I clung on. And I think Artisili was actually making jokes at the time. Jairaja shouted down calm, sort of encouraging things to me. Not to begin with, but after a while. Advising me what to do next. To move away from the rock. You need to move away from the rock so you can see where you are. But your instincts say no, you know. Yeah, he continued to advise me. He said later that thought crossed his mind, oh my God, what if Artapriya loses it? How am I going to get him up? You know, but he didn't betray that at all. And he encouraged me, and I somehow got the use of my body back, and I thrust my way forward up towards Jairaja on the ledge, and I hauled myself over the edge of the place he was standing, and I couldn't stop laughing. I just couldn't stop laughing. The relief, and the adrenaline, and I was so chuffed that I'd done it. I was so pleased that I'd done it, so satisfied. And I felt a tremendous amount of appreciation for Artisili and Jairaja, our guides, for sharing their skills, for teaching us something. They could have had a much more thrilling afternoon, the two of them, you know, without us novices, but they took us with them. And it's a really good metaphor as well for Sangha, because you're doing it on your own, but you're doing it together. So there was I on the rock face, but I have to do it in cooperation with the person above me and the person below me. That's why it's such a good metaphor, I think, for Sangha. You do it alone, but you have to do it in cooperation with others. You've got guides. And that's why it's a good metaphor for spiritual hierarchy too, because your guides don't have power over you, but they have the skills and the experience to help you if you avail yourself of their knowledge, which I did, you know, very much on that afternoon. I was so grateful for being taught something new. Yes, just like my climbing guides couldn't do it for me, they helped me enormously to help myself and be able to help the next man. The Dharma life isn't always exciting or as scary as climbing a kind of rock face, but it does involve risks. That's the topic of next week's talk. Next week's talk is called Risking It All. I want to give Bhante the last word tonight, and I'll finish with this. The development of spiritual friendship is very difficult. Leading the spiritual life is very difficult. Being a Buddhist, a real Buddhist, is very difficult. We need help. We may not have the Buddha, but we do have one another. We can help one another, encourage one another in our practice of the Dharma. We can confess our faults and weaknesses to one another. We can share our understanding with one another. We can rejoice in one another's merits. No one else can practice the Dharma for us. We have to practice it ourselves, but we do not have to practice it by ourselves. We can practice it in the company of other like-minded people who are trying to do the same. And this is the best way, in fact, the only effective way to practice.